Star Spot, episode 120 for Sunday, March 5th, 2017.
I'm Justin Trottier, and I'll be your host at the Star Spot. The Star Spot is a space-themed podcast that focuses on all aspects of astronomy and space exploration. Episodes feature interviews with guests of wide-ranging backgrounds: scientists, engineers, educators, artists, politicians, and business people. Topics are similarly broad, from the latest space mission to how the universe began, from why humans explore to how we can make exploration economical. We'll also include a segment called Current in Space, bringing you reports on news and developments that may interest the space enthusiast. You can now find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/thestarspot or follow us on Twitter at @thestarspot. The 14th annual Expanding Canada's Frontier Symposium was hosted on January 27, 2017 by the Astronomy and Space Exploration Society, a student group based at the University of Toronto. This year's unique theme was What Ifs? Is the Impossible Possible? And now, in a special three-episode series, we're joined here at the Star Spot by the event's keynote speakers as we explore three provocative questions at the cutting edge of astronomy. First up, on today's episode, Dr. Gratina Bezla asks, what if humans are around to witness the awesome collision of the Milky Way with the Andromeda Galaxy? What would that look like, and how would it affect life on Earth? But first, here's what's current in space. The Star Spot Podcast is now the Star Spot Podcast and Radio Show. That's right, your favorite astronomy program is now traveling through space, specifically the 1280 AM frequency. Our broadcaster, CJRU The Scope at Ryerson, is now available on the radio dial, which means you can join us at the Star Spot at 1280 AM every Sunday 8 PM and Tuesday 6 PM Eastern Time.
It seems every time scientists set out to search for the earliest evidence of life on Earth, the date gets pushed back. Last year, the Star Spot brought you news of 3.7 billion-year-old life harbored in stromatolites in the Issua supracrustal belt of southwest Greenland. The previous oldest known life was documented at 3.48 billion years old. We later brought you news of 4 billion-year-old biogenic carbon in chemofossils from Jag Hills in Western Australia. Now, we bring you the latest discovery published just this week in the journal Nature of life, get this, 4.3 billion years old, pushing back the date by 300 million years. Considering that Earth is only about 4.5 billion years old, this means that life could have started as soon as planetary conditions allowed for it. The groundbreaking study, led by geologists Matthew Dodd and Dominic Papineau from the University College London in the UK, presents evidence of possible life in iron-rich sedimentary rocks. The research team traveled to Nouveau-Aguitoc supracrustal belt in northwest Quebec, just off the shore of the Hudson's Bay. It's one of the oldest known rock formations on Earth. The tiny organisms would have looked like small tubule life forms with a spherical base wedged into ocean sediment and a protruding stalk in the water to gather iron, which they could use for food to metabolize by means of chemolysis. Essentially, they need to break down ferrous iron for energy. The rocks seem to indicate an oxidized biomass. Specifically, the fossilized life forms can be seen at their micrometer scale. They look almost like filamentous microorganisms, tiny iron-oxidizing bacteria that can be found in modern hydrothermal vents on the seabed. They also resemble analogous microfossils in younger rocks. And upon analysis, the scientists found that the rocks contained potential biogenic carbon in the form of carbonate and other carbonaceous material. If this evidence holds up to scientific scrutiny, it would mean that life began almost immediately on Earth. The time delay between the 4.5 billion year planetary formation mark and the 4.3 billion year life formation mark is quite small. Although we only have a planetary sample size of one, namely Earth, it gives a larger time window for life to first form on other habitable planets, perhaps exoplanets, even on candidate worlds in our own solar system, including Europa and Mars. So, this new discovery underscores the importance of not only finding exoplanets in the right place, but also at the right time. It really is astounding how resilient life can be. Whether or not it is ubiquitous in the cosmos is anyone's guess.
On April 12, 2016, Russian entrepreneur Yuri Milner announced Breakthrough Starshot, a $100 million initiative to launch a fleet of spacecraft toward our neighboring star system, Alpha Centauri. But these craft would be tiny, about the size of postage stamps, officially designated star chips. These ships may be little, but they're speedy, for conventional probes would take hundreds of thousands of years to reach Alpha Centauri, whereas a star chip could get there in as little as 20. That's fast. But there are those who think that's too fast, and fear the project's scientific potential may be wasted as a result. The concern stems from the fact that Starshot's star chips would traverse space faster than any other spacecraft before them because they're light-driven. Each star chip would be attached to a large, rectangular light sail that would be the receiving end of powerful laser pulses, 100 gigawatts to be exact, blasted from a ground-based light beamer array. These lasers would thus guide a chip and propel it beyond the solar system, ultimately aiming it at Alpha Centauri, gradually accelerating it up to 20% the speed of light. But at this incredible speed, when the chip finally reaches the stars of Alpha Sen, it might as well zip past them, with no time to perform any scientific observations to beam back to Earth. Luckily, two German scientists out of the Max Planck Institute for Solar System Research in Göttingen, René Heller and Michael Hipke, performed a study to find ways to slow down a star chip so that it may explore its destination star system. Their brilliant idea? Upon approach to Alpha Sen, a chip must activate its sail, which shall allow incoming stellar radiation to hit the sail and impart a braking force, effectively decelerating the chip. But first, the chip must approach the star Alpha Centauri A at a distance of around 4 million kilometers, traveling at roughly 4.6% the speed of light. This would enable the chip to be captured by the star's gravity, flinging it around the star and into the triple star system of Alpha Sen. Once in the system, Heller and Hipke proposed that the chip not only fly by Alpha Centauri A, but also Alpha Centauri B, then finally Proxima Centauri. To pull this off, the chip's sail would have to be deployed so that the radiation from star A not only decelerates the chip, but then hurtles it towards star B, arriving there after several days. Star B would then break the chip before launching it to Proxima Centauri, taking some 46 years to get there. But as the chip stops at each star, it could possibly study any planets that orbit them, particularly one Earth-like world recently discovered around Proxima Centauri. That one planet still has many tantalizing questions surrounding it, and an orbiting star chip would finally provide some answers. Recently, in the Astrophysical Journal, Heller and Hipke's ideas are currently being pitched to the Breakthrough Starshot team, although there's no guarantee the project will even lift off due to the technical challenges in launching laser-propelled, miniature space probes on an interstellar voyage. But Heller and Hipke are hopeful that in time, Starshot will prosper. And when it does, we can bask in the knowledge that humanity will have become not merely a spacefaring race, but a starfaring one.
The latest amazing exoplanet news was just released at a NASA-hosted press conference based on work by an international team led by Michael Guillon from the University of Liège. They have found a single system, now named TRAPPIST-1, that has seven Earth-sized planets, all transiting the star, and three of them lie in the system's habitable zone. This is a unique discovery, which ties the most planets ever found in one system, while providing the single most valuable laboratory for learning about habitable worlds aside from our own solar system. They first detected a few planets in the system back in May of 2016 using the TRAPPIST, an acronym for the Transiting Planets and Planetesimals Small Telescope, based in Chile. They followed it up with further observations using the Very Large Telescope and the Spitzer Space Telescope, amongst others, eventually confirming 7 planets, all transiting in front of their star. The fact that they were all transiting allowed for a wealth of information to be determined for each planet, including orbital characteristics, mass, radius, density, and more. They range from 0.4 to 1.4 times the mass of Earth, and are all likely rocky, so they're certainly similar to our planet in size. As for their orbits, well, this is where it gets strange. Their star is a red dwarf, only 8% the mass of the Sun. In fact, it's not much bigger in radius than Jupiter. Its tiny size means it is also very cool, less than half the surface temperature of our Sun, so it is good for the 7 worlds that they are all tucked very tight to it. While Earth orbits our Sun at a distance of 1 AU, they orbit theirs in a matter of days, at distances ranging from only 1% of an AU out to 6% of an AU. That means all of them would fit easily within Mercury's orbit of 40% of an AU. In fact, their orbital distances are more comparable to Jupiter's system of moons. It also makes them all staggeringly close together, some of them not far off the Earth-Moon distance. In fact, while we see solar system planets as wandering stars in the night, observers living in this system could see another planet as clear as we see our moon, and even several times larger. So, could there be life in this system? 3 of the planets are located in the habitable zone, after all, and have the potential for surface liquid water. The innermost of those 3 experiences possibly the most Earth-like temperatures, despite its tiny 6-day orbital period. One cautionary note is that red dwarf stars like this one can have powerful flares, capable of burning away nearby atmospheres. So for now, we can only speculate. However, further observation should be able to tell us some real specifics about their atmospheres, as is usually the case with transiting planets. In fact, the Hubble telescope has already taken a look as part of the confirmation process, and showed that the worlds likely do not have hydrogen and helium atmospheres, further indicating that they are in fact rocky like ours. This system will certainly be a gold mine for learning about rocky worlds, so we should expect lots of follow-up observations. Hubble and Spitzer are planning more study, Kepler is already looking, and future telescopes like the JWST will certainly tell us a great deal. We will analyze their atmospheres closely for biomarker signs of molecules like oxygen, methane, or carbon dioxide, and someday we will hopefully know if there's anything breathing there. The system is 40 light-years away, so for now, we'll be watching from afar, wondering if anyone is there, seeing their 6 neighbor worlds dancing through their night and day skies, or maybe they're already making the short-hop trip from world to world.
And that's what's current in space. Dr. Gratina Besla is Assistant Professor of Astronomy at the University of Arizona and Principal Investigator of the Outreach Project TimeStep. She is part of a number of collaborations, including Tiny Titans, which aims to quantify the role of dwarf interactions and mergers as drivers of galaxy evolution, and also SMASH, which is studying the Magellanic Clouds, our Milky Way galaxy's largest satellite galaxies. Dr. Besla received her PhD from Harvard University. Well, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined here at the Star Spot by Dr. Gratina Besla. Thanks for being on the show.
Yep, I'm excited to be here.
I know you don't have a lot of time, Dr. Besla, because you're about to go on stage as part of the ASX symposium here in Toronto. But I'm glad that you found some time for us. I want to talk a little bit about 2 topics. The first one is colliding galaxies, which is what you're going to be talking about tonight. So my first question is, how long have we known that we're in for a collision?
We've known for a pretty long time. So I would say probably about the best past, since like the early, it's got to be like 70 or 80 years. Like we,
really?
Since we've basically found radial velocity measurements, we've known that that M31 was coming towards us.
This is the Andromeda Galaxy.
Yeah, that's right. So the Andromeda Galaxy is heading towards us, and we know this. Actually, I'll be showing some plots about this, but we know this because the light that's coming towards us from the Andromeda Galaxy is what we call blue-shifted,
right,
by the Doppler effect. So that tells us it's coming towards us. So I'm not entirely sure exactly how long, but much, much longer than you might have expected.
Now, have we been certain that our fate was a collision, or have we needed to gather data before we could be, you know, more certain about that?
Right. So this is totally what's cool about what's going on fairly recently,
yeah,
is that we really didn't know exactly when the collision was going to happen. We didn't know if it was going to be a collision. Would it miss us the first time and come back around?
Right.
And that required knowing very precisely how fast and what direction the galaxy was moving in. And we've only known that for the past, I guess, since 2012.
That's
the first time that we've measured it.
Right. And some of that more recent data is what you're going to be sharing with
that's
us
right
tonight, I imagine.
Yeah.
And how common is it for two galaxies in the universe to collide?
You know, so we find a lot of examples of it locally, but it's not really that common right now.
Hmm.
We think that it used to be much, much more common at early times. And the reason is because the universe is expanding. So everything's kind of moving away from everything
right
else. And so when things are, you know, in your low-density space, when there's not very many neighbors nearby, the odds of colliding into something become lower. But at early times, it seems to be just the way everything was. Everything was colliding into everything else.
So are we a late bloomer as a local group of galaxies?
Absolutely.
What accounts for us doing this so late in cosmic life?
Yeah, so we're kind of an outlier in this. We certainly are a bit more rare to have just mm-hmm one big companion nearby, and we are on this kind of orbit where we went away from each other, and now we're coming back at each other. And it's just, it does seem to be not a particularly common thing.
So do we have reason to believe that before we were approaching each other, we are in our history, we had actually been closer and then we moved further
apart?
That's
right. So the idea is that everything was closer to everything else in the past,
right,
because now everyone's moving away from each other. So if all the galaxies are moving away from each other now, they used to be fairly close by. So we have the premise that everything started off being very close to each other and then has moved away. And now is coming back at
it. And that would include Andromeda and the Milky Way.
That's right.
Now, you mentioned that originally we didn't know, you know, when we first discovered that the Andromeda seemed to be heading towards us 70, 80 years ago, we didn't know exactly what the dynamics of that interaction would be like. What do we believe they're going to look like now? Like, how are they actually going to end up approaching each other exactly?
Right. So, yeah, this is the spoilers of my talk. Yeah, absolutely. So
we won't broadcast this until well after your talk,
okay,
so you're safe.
So it's going to... The idea is that it'll become, right now we have two disk galaxies, two spiral galaxies.
Yeah.
So all the stars are kind of rotating in a coherent way, and it's a very thin disk. And in the end, when these two things smash into each other, it's going to turn into something more like an elliptical galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be more spheroidal in shape. Stars are going to have more random orbits, and so you're not going to see a thin, nice disk on the sky anymore. You won't see this band of light that we attribute to the Milky Way. It'll be kind of stars all over the place.
So right now, both Andromeda and the Milky Way are spiral galaxies.
That's
is
right
that correct? They kind of twins of each other almost.
Yeah, that's right.
But neither one will survive in terms of that kind
of
structure.
That's right. Both are going to combine into one thing and the structure will be completely different from what it was today.
What happens to the two cores, the two galactic centers? Do they kind of merge as
They're totally going to merge. So we do believe that there is a supermassive black hole in the center of our Milky Way and in the center of,
right,
and the Andromeda Galaxy. And so when these two galaxies collide, their black holes are also going to merged together. But exactly what's going to happen is a little bit tricky to tell.
Okay.
And so there isn't a lot of gas around, and there isn't, so, you know, we think of like supermassive black holes eating all this material and throwing things out. It's unlikely for that to actually happen because there's not a lot of fuel around.
Okay. So it's not just a simple matter of two supermassive black holes, they merge, they become twice as big. That's not exactly what happens?
Well, that probably is roughly what's going to happen. I think that's the idea, at least, is that they'll kind of grow in that way. But sometimes when two black holes get really close together, they can kick each other. So there are actually general relativity effects that occur. And so that's why I'm being cagey about my answer here, because we have this, there's a theory that, you know, you can actually kick out a black hole during a merger. So it's not exactly obvious that supermassive black holes just grow by colliding. It's more likely they grow by eating a lot of gas.
So do you mean one of those supermassive black holes could get kicked out of the entire superstructure of these two
merging
galaxies?
Or the merged object can kind of get kicked out. That's right. So
you just have a floating supermassive black hole.
Right.
Heading
yeah.
Out
I mean,
into
people are looking for these.
Space.
The idea is called recoiling black holes,
okay.
And it's an entire area of study. And people are trying to see signatures of this effect because it does put constraints on general relativity and our theories of what happens when you get close to singularities, essentially. Where
too bad we can't wait like 3 billion years to just kind
right,
of
so
watch
to
it
look,
happen here.
Exactly. So you have to look into other galaxies to see what's going to happen there.
What about recoiling stars? Are there stars that end up getting sent outside of the merging structure?
So stars will certainly get sent out to large distances and get kicked up. But the issue is that at the same time, the mass of our Milky Way and Andromeda together, it's going to be twice as much as each one of them individually.
A lot of gravity there.
That's right, exactly. So it'll hold on to all the stars. It's very unlikely that a star would get ejected completely from the system.
We don't have a lot of time, and there's so much more I could ask about that. But I want to turn to the second sort of half of our discussion. And this has to do with the Magellanic Clouds, the large and small Magellanic Clouds, these dwarf galaxies that circle the Milky Way, and they're actually much closer than Andromeda. Maybe just by way of transitioning from one topic to another, how do they compare in terms of size and distance as compared to Andromeda?
Yeah, so the large and small Magellanic Clouds are about like 160,000 light years from us. The Andromeda Galaxy is 2.5 million light years away from us, so it's much, much further away. Also, these Magellanic Clouds are about, the big one is about a factor of 10 smaller than our galaxy.
Okay.
And so similarly with M31, with Andromeda. So as a result, we're talking about smaller galaxies that are going around our own Milky Way. But interestingly, Andromeda also has a galaxy that's similar to the large Magellanic Cloud in mass.
That orbits the Andromeda.
So both the Milky Way and Andromeda have kind of big satellites that orbit around each other.
So we have these two dwarf galaxies, and I understand now we believe that there's more than two galaxies that orbit the Milky Way.
Yeah, we're up
Milky
to something like 50, and it just keeps growing. Yeah.
Wow.
It's increasing by a lot, and the reason is because the sensitivity of our surveys are getting better.
So the large and the small are I suppose, the biggest of two dwarf galaxies that circle us. They orbit the Milky Way. Do they also have interesting dynamics among themselves, among their fellow dwarf galaxies?
So the interesting thing is when you look by themselves at these two galaxies, they look like they're two very distinct things on the sky. But when you look in the radio, you find that they're connected by a bridge of gas and a tail of gas that spans across the sky about 150 degrees across the sky.
Wow.
It's a huge structure. And we think that that was formed by the mutual interactions between these two galaxies. Hmm. So they're smashing into each other and spewing all this gas all over the place.
So, that's gas that connects them to each other us?
To them.
Milky Way.
Yeah, that's
to
these two to each other. But whether or not they interact with any of the other small things, we don't know for sure. But people think they might.
Now, you've put forward an interesting new theory that sort of competes a little bit with mainstream views on this, or perhaps former mainstream views on this, which has to do with the origin of the large and small Magellanic Clouds. What's your belief in terms of where they come from?
Right. So, the trick is that we don't know how long, for sure, how long the Magellanic Clouds have been near our Milky Way. Recently, we've clocked them moving quite fast, and that kind of changed the canonical picture where they've been always orbiting around our Milky Way. So the new picture is they're moving too fast, so they must have come from much farther distances away and are only entering our vicinity fairly recently. So they're coming in close to us for the first time. What that means is we're in a really special place in time to be able to see them so easily in our night sky, whereas before you couldn't. In terms of where they came from, we think they kind of came from the same place as the Milky Way and Andromeda. If everything in the past was closer together, just like the Andromeda Galaxy and the Milky Way moved away from each other and came back in, I think that the Magellanic Clouds also were very close by at early times and then moved away, very, very far away, and then came back in.
So their origin is definitely not within the Milky Way. It's not like they got, thrown out from the Milky Way and became a separate galaxy.
No, that's right.
Could not have happened.
I mean, I think we don't know for sure all the details of what happened at the beginning. Essentially we're arguing about what's happening at the beginning of time.
Right.
So the very details at the very beginning are unclear, but it does seem like they formed as distinct objects. They have a long history and a chemical history that's very different from our own galaxy.
So it
doesn't look like they followed the same kind of
path. They're lower in metallicity,
I think,
in particular.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
So if they've only, according to this theory, if they've only sort of joined the neighborhood, as it were, recently, do we know when that might have happened and how that we acquired them?
So we think it happened about 1 billion years ago. A billion to 2 billion years ago.
Okay.
Well, at least that's my theory, at any rate. And that's what I feel like the data is telling us. And in terms of, what was the second part of your question?
The nature of how they were acquired.
Right. So massive galaxies acquire other galaxies just by basically by their gravity. Yeah. They attract them back. So right. This is the same idea that Andromeda and the Milky Way were moving away from each other, but then their mutual gravitational attraction pulled them back. And the same idea here, right? So the Magellanic Clouds went out to large distances and the Milky Way pulled them back.
Yeah. Now, I understand, just in researching this, that there's a long filament of hydrogen gas that connects the clouds, these two dwarf galaxies, to our own galaxy.
So it's not quite connecting it to our galaxy. It's just sort of orbiting around the galaxy.
Oh, okay.
So we think it's actually quite... This filament of gas is at very large distances away from us, and it's trailing behind them. So we think it formed really by the two galaxies themselves interacting with each other and pulling gas out, and it had very little to do with our own Milky Way. So this is the new theory that we put forward, because the issue is... The way people thought about it before is that if they've always been going around the Milky Way pulls out gas from them. But if they haven't, if they've only come in recently, you don't have enough time to do this. So now we have to think of another way
to explain where that originated. Okay. And your theory would explain that as being a factor of the galaxies themselves, their own dynamic with respect to each other.
That's right.
Okay. And I guess just the last question is, if this theory, this new theory, this new way of looking at things is correct, how does that change our understanding of galactic evolution in a kind of looking at it more generally? What can we say about how galaxies in general evolve, you know, over cosmic time?
Yeah, so I think what I like to say about these kinds of systems is it teaches us that small galaxies aren't really all that small, and their interactions with each other are not trivial, and they do actually matter. So we tend to think about galaxy evolution on these small galaxies as being basically processed by a galaxy like our Milky Way. Milky Way has tides that strip the material from these galaxies and remove gas, and so that's the only thing that matters. But it doesn't seem to be completely true. It seems that small galaxies can interact with each other, and their history of interactions and mergers and all the rest of that may actually be really important for how they evolve, and eventually then how they feed galaxies like the Milky Way with gas. So without the interactions between these galaxies, you wouldn't get this filament of hydrogen gas trailing behind them. And right now, that filament is feeding gas into the halo of the Milky Way, so surroundings of the Milky Way. And eventually that gas will fall back onto the galaxy and form new stars. Without that fuel, we can't form new stars.
Right.
So how gas gets out of these small things matters, and I think that really has to do with these interactions between these two galaxies, which no one's really thinking about yet, but I think it's moving in that direction.
So in terms of the direction we're going in our research, what is the next step in terms of trying to, you know, definitively rule on this particular question, your theory versus what's been the mainstream?
So
how can we settle it?
We need new surveys about these small galaxies kind of away from big things like our Milky Way. So I'm working alongside a number of other astronomers, also in particular Sabrina Steerwalt over at NRAO, to work on a survey of small galaxies. We call it tiny titans, these small things smashing into each other. And they're pairs and interacting low-mass galaxies, and we're hitting them with every wavelength possible, getting the gas content, star formation rates, everything, so we can understand how dramatic these kinds of interactions can actually be. And once we have that, all those observations in place, at the same time I'm leading a big theoretical initiative to understand how that fits into the context of these huge galaxy simulations that we're building, and how often do these interactions actually happen. So that's what we're trying to do right now, and then we can put that into, well, if all this is happening without a big galaxy going nearby, what happens after that galaxy captures this interacting system? So not one galaxy at a time that it's capturing, it's actually capturing many.
Got it. Professor Gratina Besla, thanks so much for joining us here at the Star Spot. Thanks for being at University of Toronto for the symposium, and good luck with the speech tonight.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us at the Star Spot. Mind and universe continually expanding.
The Star Spot with Justin Trottier is an astronomy and space-themed podcast based out of Toronto, Canada. Please send comments or questions to starspotpodcast@gmail.com. The Star Spot is produced by Ying Zhang Li. Marketing and promotions by Natalie Morcos. Guest hosting by Denise Fong. News production by Benjamin Jenkins. News contributions from Julia Mazurchuk, Mallory Warren, Jessica Campbell, and Victoria Duncan. Web design by Blair Renault. Graphics by Carmina Svillens. And I'm your host, Justin Trottier. Thank you for listening.